There's enormous power in goals. The moment a goal is established, it has the same effect in a many sense as a vision. A vision is the long-term picture of a final scene. For instance, to see your 50th wedding anniversary, to envision who would be there, what the feeling would be, how cohesive and unified and harmonious the family would be, how much that they would care for each other. Sandra and I have done a great deal of this kind of envisioning. Goals would be more short-term, measurable, not always measurable though, maybe discernible accomplishments on the way to that vision. So everything I've talked about, the power of vision, the passion of vision, really is associated with the power of goals. If you take the four basic needs and capabilities of our nature, to live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy, and then think in terms of each role, it becomes a very, very useful framework of thinking in developing goals. For instance, in your work, you have to live, you have to provide a livelihood. But also in your work, you want relationships. You also want to promote learning and development, including your own, and to make a contribution. There's all four. Okay, your role as a family person. There needs to be sustaining and the helping them to sustain themselves, to become independent. See, that becomes to live, to love. You can't do that and have motivational influence and power unless there's cohesiveness and caring about each other. To learn, to create a learning environment in the home so it's constantly getting feedback and data on how well it's doing, how well people are doing, so that there is a great premium on learning. I think of goals more in terms of character and contribution than in terms of material things, such as making so much money this month or this year. But I'm not against those. Those could be worthy goals as well. But I find that the more I attach my goals to the kinds of contributions I want to make and the kinds of characteristics I want to develop in order to make those contributions, then I think everything else tends to work together for my good. Take today, for instance, doing this audio program on my weekly organizer. Instead of putting down, do an audio program, or do an excellent job of an audio program, the goal was, and I had to listen very carefully to my conscience, get sufficiently deep to where my passion comes to bear on my insights, my convictions. That was my goal. Now, 2 days ago, I didn't pay the price in a presentation. They thought it was good. I knew otherwise. And my wife's very honest with me. She knew otherwise. In fact, she always says, what grade? And I say C minus, D. My kids and others, oh, that was wonderful. I know otherwise. Inwardly, I know. And I found that my discernment is so much more accurate than measurement or observation, and so much tougher. But I have to pay a price. Every time, every day, I cannot miss one significant thing. What is the goal for this presentation? If I'm trying to teach empowerment, for instance, I have to write down, I have to go deep so that I have integrated and have a new insight that excites me. Then I'm prepared. That's what I mean by a goal. Now, an activity is the process of getting there. They're very interwoven, so I'm not too hung up on the semantics. Activities flow into goals, activities. Ends and means are inseparable. The problem is, many mission statements are only value statements. You want to be good, yes, but you want to be good for something. What are you about? It's the vision part of the mission statement, in my opinion, that will test the value part of the mission statement as to whether they're really based on principles and whether you'll stay with them or not, because a lot of people will let the end justify the means. Ends and means are inseparable. You may accomplish some worthy end, but somewhere else, if you use an unworthy means, something else has happened. One of my dear friends and associates told this story. He was attending someone who was teaching how to prioritize, the importance of it, and so forth. And the teacher had a large table with a very large cloth over it, so you couldn't see anything under it. On top of the table was a large open-mouth jar, and then there were a group of rocks next to it, a about the size of one's fist. And he would say to the group, "Let's see how many of these we can get in here. How many would you guess?" And they'd guess back and forth and talk. And he'd put them in, one after another, all these big rocks inside this jar. And it would fill it right up to the top. "Can we get any more in?" "No." And some, "Well, maybe." They'd work it through and rearrange, might get one or two more. And then everyone agreed, "That's all you can get in." "Is everyone settled?" "Yes." Then he'd pull out from underneath the cloth of the table a box of pebbles. And he would then put those in, and they would filter down and fill in the various spaces between the rocks. And he'd shake the jar, and then he'd get more in there, and he'd shake it more in there, and it would fill it up. By this time, they were getting aware of what was happening. So he said, "Is that all?" And people would say, "No, no, get sand in there." So he'd pull out a box of sand, he'd pour sand in, and it would go into the other spaces that the pebbles didn't occupy. "Is that all? Put water in there." He'd pull out a pitcher of water, he'd pour all the way in. Then another pitcher, all the way in, till gradually it was totally full. And that was it. Then he'd break them into small groups to discuss the meaning of it. They'd come up with different explanations, different lessons that they would see in this example, this demonstration, such as, it's amazing how many things, if you try hard enough, you can get into your life. But the lesson that he wanted to teach was, you couldn't get anything in if you didn't put the big rocks in first. If it was filled with water, you couldn't even get sand in. You couldn't get rocks in, pebbles. It would cause the water to run out. If your life is filled with a thick of thin things, what are you going to do when something truly significant blindsides you? It's going to cause such disruption to your whole life and to other people around. Could be very, very disturbing. The key is to, in a sense, start with a clean slate and ask the question, what is truly important? What is our vision? And what are the principles we want to operate on? Then try to get the sense of goals for each of those roles that we have in our lives, in terms of to live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy. Then do it annually. Then at the smallest unit, weekly, so that you're still in a proactive state of mind, you're not reacting to the urgent, keeps you in quadrant two, a quadrant two mindset, but you're putting the big rocks in first. I find myself, I have to work on a long-term calendar. Then I schedule those big rocks so that I never miss anything significant, including my children's games, performances, graduations, birthdays, the big events. And we build a great deal of tradition around these things and try to get a lot of support. I don't want to set my family up as an example because we have our own struggles and challenges, but I'm just saying that I am a struggler in trying to apply these same principles into our family. And I have found that you have to do long-term thinking. You have to have a vision of your family, and they have to share in that vision. It's very important. The perspective of the week. What does that mean? The smallest unit of organizing is a week, the smallest unit, not the day. You adapt daily, you adapt hourly, you even adapt moment by moment. But the smallest unit is a week. Psychologically and socially, it is a very well-established window in people's lives. They think in terms of weeks. There's usually one day where they take off for other purposes. Then they go back to their work week. Then there's the weekend, then there's the work week, the weekend. If you think in terms of a week, psychologically and socially, you're very, very much in alignment with environmental reinforcement. But you could also think in terms of days, which would be in alignment with environmental reinforcement of urgency. But you've got to stop it with that, because that'll keep you in quadrant one, not quadrant two. Quadrant two means you have to act upon it. Therefore, you take a space of time, a week, as the smallest unit, so you can think of each of the roles that you have identified and that you feel is very important, and you think of a goal or two for each of those roles, and then you schedule it. You schedule it softly. Why? Because something else more important may come up, and it may eclipse that, and you're more focused upon people and relationships, roles and goals and vision than you are on schedules. So it's very soft.
In discussing step 5, integrity in the moment of choice, we'll take a closer look at how to access that inner compass in any moment of choice. We'll talk about how to be strong in hard moments, how to know when the unexpected opportunity or challenge is more important than what you've planned, and how to either stay with what you've planned or change with peace of mind.
Integrity in the moment of choice, meaning you're integrated based on principles. At the core are principles. You give an integrated response. You have a sense of wisdom. You have a sense of balance and perspective about everything that is happening. So you'll adapt. If you've made an unequivocal commitment, your integrity would say, keep it. If the circumstances change and it's not wise to make it, then you ask to be released from the commitment. I'll never forget one time working with an organization, and I brought in some very powerful resource people to this organization. And I became one of them as well, and we presented some material that they needed desperately and knew it. But inwardly, I knew it was still rhetoric and theory. And until they would change structures and systems to be in alignment with the principles contained with the material, they would fall back to old ways within a matter of days, if not weeks, so that the net effect of the whole 3-day training experience would only be to guilt-trip them. In fact, it would be just another one of those ephemeral kind of quick fixes, Band-Aid aspirin approaches with the wonderful language associated to it, including my own, which had no effect upon people, on organizations. But I didn't have a long-standing relationship with that organization. I hadn't cultivated such a communication with them that they were going to rely on me. I liked to have continued to work with them. And I knew if I were to be a true professional, I had to be more true to principles than to them, just like I would want a doctor to be more true to principles of his or her profession than to me. That would be the highest way of being true to me. I knew that I'd have to do the same thing with them. So I said to myself, are you going to stand up to your professional responsibility and tell them what you really think, that they've got to change structures and systems to accommodate these principles, or else they're wasted their time for these 3 days? Because I'm telling you, they were in a euphoric high. People were excited, and it was coming to the end of the 3-day, and that I want to lay out this sobering challenge, that nothing's going to happen unless they change structures and systems to build these principles into them, that they'll just go back to old ways. So I sat there, and I went through this internal dialogue. What's the worst thing that can happen if I do the thing I know I should? I concluded, the worst thing is they'll fire me. Can I live with that? Yes, I can live with that. I've got so many other options and alternatives. Now, if I didn't have any other options and alternatives, that would have been a much tougher decision. So that's why it's so important to continually do quadrant 2 work and professional development work and client development work so that you have options and alternatives. That increases your courage. Then I asked the question, what's the worst thing that can happen if I don't do the thing I know I should? It'll be a wasted seminar. Can I live with that? I will not have fulfilled my responsibility as a professional. Can I live with that? No, that would violate my integrity, and I can't live with that. So let's go for it. Now, the way I went for it was this way. I told them the struggle I just went through. Remember this, that which is most personal is most universal. When you begin to describe the internal struggle that you're going through inside yourself, everyone relates. You know why? They're going through the same struggle. Those executives out there know that they would have to go through a profound struggle to change structures and systems when the whole culture has gradually been shaped by those and has shaped them, and that there are risks in these kinds of changes. But they also know the long-term risk in the marketplace, if they don't do it, is infinitely greater. But then they have to carry the personal risk, see? So I describe exactly what was happening inside me. They related to that. So I finally said, I've got to level with you. And then I did. And at the end, the standing ovation had nothing to do with the content. It had everything to do with the fact that we all knew it had to be done. And also they were saying, thank you for leveling with us. Thank you for showing that courage. because I didn't have a standing ovation, and neither did the other presenters at the end of our speeches, which were far better than this short response that I'd given. So what it taught me, and there's been many times in my professional life and in my personal life with my children, with my wife, and most significantly with myself, when I've had to go through that internal debate to rise to the occasion to do it.